Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. Today we take a closer look at how American women won their freedom and opened the campaigns in the 20th century battles for civil rights. Elaine Weiss joins us to talk about her book, The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, which just won the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
So I think there may be a lot of people who don't realize what a battle this was. So how did this bit of history come onto your radar screen?
Well, I realized I am a very dedicated voter. My parents taught me how important it was to vote in every election, and I've taught my children that. I really believe that it's everyone's responsibility who lives in a democracy to vote. But at some point, I realized that I did not know how I had, as an American woman, had at one point not had the vote because the founding fathers had purposely left us out. And then at some point in our history, I did. And I realized I didn't know how or when that had happened. And I spoke to some of my very well-educated friends who also did not know how it had happened. Yeah. And so I realized this was a gaping hole in our understanding of our nation and of how a democracy can expand and change.
Now, some may have a notion that this fight for women's rights had support from all the women, but that was not the case at all.
No, it wasn't. And I think that was truly one of the great surprises in my research when I realized, when I came across the documents that explained that there were organized groups of women opposing women's suffrage, opposing their own sisters receiving or winning the greatest right of a democracy, which is the vote. And they had many reasons for opposing it, some of them religious, some of them cultural, some of them political. And the fact that they organized against it and worked in what we might say was against their own best interests, I found both fascinating and a little horrifying, but also very instructive when we look at our divisive politics today. It teaches us a lot.
And the book follows many stories, but three women in particular, and then the climax of the seven-decade struggle for equal citizenship. And I think that's a fact that many may not realize. This was a long, bitter struggle.
Yes, it was. And I think, and I put myself in this category, we have this very fuzzy notion of how American women obtained the vote. It's usually in our textbooks, it's usually a sentence, maybe a paragraph, and it usually says something like, women met at Seneca Falls in 1848 to demand their rights, and then in 1920, men gave the right to vote to women. And that's just a very inadequate explanation. It did take more than seven decades. It took three generations of really fearless, dedicated women and men who were suffragists, and they fought over 900 battles, both at the state and local and national level, before women won the vote. And it really was a battle for seven decades.
Yeah. Now, you write, the controversy over ratification of the 19th Amendment, and more broadly, the long battle over women's suffrage, wasn't simply a political argument. It was also a social, cultural, and moral debate, a precursor to what we now call cultural wars, raising issues that were complex and divisive.
Yes, yeah. That was another revelation for me when I realized that we think of suffrage, women's suffrage, if we think of it at all, as this little bubble that kind of settled down into our history, that it was not buffeted by political or economic or social storms, which were raging in the 19th and early 20th century. But it was affected by all of these. And the idea that this wasn't just a political decision, for many, it was a moral and a cultural and a societal shift, which they feared. They thought that the idea of women demanding their political equality by demanding the vote would bring about the moral downfall of the nation, because it wasn't just a political action. It would affect private life as well as public life. And in that way, it was a much more difficult, passionate, multi-layered decision. Yeah. It was really a decision about women's role in society. It wasn't just whether they could vote.
Yeah,
and that's what made it so complex and so divisive.
And interesting, too, when we talk about all these different reasons people had who did oppose, you know, one was, well, if we give the women the right to vote, that means black women, which will mean black men. So there was the race issue. And there was, you know, as you mentioned, the what they thought would be the demise of the home and the family. And even more complex were some of the industries of the time who were afraid how the women might vote. You know, you had, you know, prohibition and you know, you had all these ties to this industry. They were like, well, we can't give women the right to vote because, you know, they'll shut us down.
Yes, there were definitely corporate, besides ideological and cultural opponents of women gaining the vote, there were corporate interests at stake. And it was really interesting, again, broadening our view of what the suffrage movement was and how complicated it was. I found that there was dark money coursing through the anti-suffrage movement, because there were many corporations and businesses who thought that women voting would be bad for their bottom line, not unlike corporations making political decisions today. For instance, the textile manufacturers were very much against women gaining the ballot, because they feared that if women could vote, if mothers could vote, they might well want to abolish child labor. Mm-hmm. And child labor was the backbone of the textile industry. It was cheap. And if it was abolished, or if women demanded equal pay, then that was going to affect their bottom line. Yeah. And so they worked very strenuously to oppose suffrage in the states and in Congress. And we see them at work in Tennessee in that last battle. And the liquor interests are also very involved, because they fear, even though prohibition is in effect by summer of 1920, when my book takes place, they're hoping that if they can keep women away from the polling booth, that prohibition won't be enforced quite as stringently as prohibition laws promised to do. And so they're hoping they can keep women away and just be a wink and a nod, and prohibition won't be very painful for them. Hmm. And there are other industries like the railroad industry, which opposes women coming in because it's going to upset the status quo in state legislatures, and they need state legislatures for favors for their companies. So it gets very interesting. Mm-hmm. And we see that corporate involvement in big issues of the time is nothing new.
Right. So let's hear a little bit more about our three main characters, if you will. Tell us a little bit more about Carrie Catt. She was president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association.
Yes, Carrie Catt is such a fascinating part of this story. She's truly an engaging and overlooked part of the suffrage movement. I hope to bring her back into the spotlight. She is the leader of the mainstream suffragists. The suffrage movement has split at this point, as it had in Great Britain, and there's a sort of mainstream, more conservative organization, and that's the National. And then there's Alice Paul and her Women's Party, which is impatient with the slow and plodding ways of the National, and break off and take more radical steps. But Carrie Catt is a protege of Susan Anthony. She was trained by Anthony, taken on the road, shown the ropes, given more and more responsibility. And Susan Anthony actually taps Carrie Catt to be her successor as the leader of the movement in America. And Catt is also the leader of the International Suffrage Alliance at this time, which is the international assembly of suffrage organizations, because this is not just happening in America, it is happening around the world. And so we see her as a leader, a diplomat, an orator, and a master strategist. Mm. she is the one who makes the blueprint of how the suffrage movement is finally going to get a constitutional amendment guaranteeing women the right to vote. They had to work for 40 years. Mm-hmm. The amendment was stuck in Congress for 40 years. And she has to engineer how it's going to get out of Congress, finally get passed in 1919. And we're, in fact, celebrating the centennial anniversary of congressional passage right now. Mm-hmm. And you may have seen pictures of Speaker Nancy Pelosi wearing white the other day with a yellow rose. So we're celebrating that now. And Carrie Catt was very much the engineer of that whole process. And so we see her in Nashville, Tennessee, in the final battle, weary, scared, determined that her life's work and her legacy will be protected. And we see her challenged by the situation that emerges in Tennessee and close to defeat. Yeah. So it's a fascinating portrait of a woman leader. And she was probably one of the most famous women in the world at this time in 1920, confronting corruption and political intransigency and misogyny, mm-hmm. and having to battle through.
Then you mentioned Alice Paul and her group, the National Woman's Party. And now we have Sue White, the young activist for the National Woman's Party. Tell us a little more about Sue.
Yeah. So Sue White is a native Tennessean. She's only 32 years old. And she's part of that third young generation of suffragists who are tired of waiting, tired of pleading for the vote, tired of asking for the vote. And they're determined to be confrontational, to be disruptive, all the words we've been hearing lately, to not be polite, to be in their face. And she takes her women to the picket line, which had never been done before. They picket the White House. They do things that, this is now wartime during World War I, that are considered treasonous and traitorous. And they're imprisoned. They're tortured in prison. Sue White is also imprisoned. And they are willing to commit civil disobedience, practice civil disobedience, break the law in order to get the attention of the press and the American people, and to almost shame the president and Congress and the states into finally giving women equality. And it's a very interesting view of how social movements often split like this. We see it happen in the labor movement. The Wobblies go off on their own more radical way. It happens in the civil rights movement, certainly later in the 20th century, happens in the gay rights movement. So it's a kind of natural evolution of progressive movements, reform movements, but it's very painful. And whether it was disruptive or the synergy of the two groups working together is what historians still debate, whether it retarded ratification or it promoted it. Is an interesting topic. I think they needed both approaches. Yeah. But Sue White is sent by Alice Paul, she's one of her young lieutenants, back home to Tennessee to lead the strategy of the Women's Party for ratification in her home state. And she knows the legislators. She's more of a native, of course. And so she brings that knowledge to her strategy. So we have two suffrage groups, both with the same goal, both with the same hopes, and yet they work separately. They have separate staffs. They have separate headquarters in the same hotel. So we see that women's groups do not always agree, even when they agree ideologically. So that's an important lesson for us, too.
Right. And the very different styles, which I'm going to talk about in a little bit. But now we need to hear about Josephine Pearson. She's president of the Tennessee State Association opposed to women's suffrage.
Yes. Josephine is an anti, as they called, women who opposed women's suffrage. And she is opposed for many of the reasons that antis suffer claim as their ideological basis. One is she is religiously and culturally very conservative. She's from she's a minister's daughter from the southern part of Tennessee, and she really believes that women's suffrage goes against the will of God. It's against God's plan. And there are many clergymen who agree with her that God made men to be dominant over women, and Eve should not demand equality with Adam, and it goes against biblical teaching. And so she uses the Bible, as they do, to refute the arguments of the suffragists. You know, this mm-hmm. is just against the will of God. Right. And her other reasons are that she believes that women belong in the home, that they are to be the queens of their castles and not to emerge from it. That they are should be at home. They should not be in the dirty realm of politics. They should not be arguing with their husbands, perhaps, mm-hmm. about who to vote for. And her third main reason is she, as a Southern woman, is appalled by the idea that Black women would also be able to vote, and perhaps in gaining political equality would have a sense of social equality. And this would upset the whole notion of white supremacy in her native state. And she will do anything to fight that.
Right. We're talking with Elaine Wise. Her book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elaine Wise, the author of The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Now, here we are, summer of 1920, and 35 states have approved the 19th Amendment. We need one more to become law. 8 states rejected it. 3 were refusing to consider it. So that leaves North Carolina and Tennessee. North Carolina, we're pretty sure, is not going to vote that way. So Tennessee was really the only chance to see this amendment ratified. And you talked about Carrie Catt and how she was warned and scared because she knew this. She knew this was the moment that if they didn't get this done now, this was going to be a lost cause.
Yes, she and the suffragists are very nervous because Tennessee is a terrible place to have to stage this definitive battle. Most of the other Southern states have already rejected the 19th Amendment. They've refused to ratify, including the state where I live, Maryland. So they see the 1920 presidential election coming up in the fall, which is a great push. They want to be part of this decision. It's going to be an election where the nation is deciding what its role in the world is going to be, whether it's going to be isolationist or whether it's going to be a leader of the free world. And there are many issues like immigration and labor, industries being, industries threatened by automation mm-hmm. and by technological progress. A lot of issues that we're facing today, and women wanted to be part of that decision making in the 1920 election. And what the suffragists saw correctly was that the nation was swinging away from the progressive era. It was swinging into a more isolationist and really reactionary mode. And that happened in the 1920s. 1920s were really quite politically conservative. And they see that happening. They see the presidential candidates, Warren Harding, who is running on a platform of return to normalcy and America first, and is against America's entry into the League of Nations. And then James Cox, running for the Democrats with his vice presidential candidate, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And they offer another choice of joining the League of Nations. And so America's going to make big decisions. And what the suffragists fear is that if they lose in Tennessee, they will be set back for the foreseeable future. And they're right about this. Mm. And perhaps not. They might lose the amendment. And those of us who've lived through the Equal Rights Amendment, which, by the way, was introduced into Congress in 1923, it's been 96 years, we know that an amendment can come close to ratification and not make it to the finish line. And that's what they feared. And they had very good reason to fear it. A Southern state was a very tough place mm-hmm. To stake their entire movement.
Yeah.
But they had no choice.
And you know what's interesting? This is something I did not know, but it's interesting to know that some women in this country did already have the right to vote in a handful of states out west.
Yeah, so it gets kind of complicated. And I didn't know that either. What states in the Constitution, states are in control of election laws. And we know that today because we know certain states are making it hard for their citizens to vote. And this is a problem, but it all stems from the way voting is structured. So states are in charge of their election laws. And so suffrage or the right to vote can be granted by either state law or by a federal constitutional amendment, which will supersede all the state laws. So the suffragists tried it both ways. They worked for changes in state constitutions, which prohibited women from voting. They tried to stimulate referenda in the state so that the voters, but of course these are only men who can vote, deciding whether women should have the vote. So it's like a popular referendum on whether women should vote, but only men get a say. And there are scores of these referenda that go on between 1870 and in 1920. And in some cases, they finally, after many defeats, succeed. And in the Western states, there's more of an openness to women voting. And there's lots of historical reasons for that. Partly there aren't too many women out there in the pioneering states. And this becomes a sort of draw, like come to Wyoming and you'll have the vote. So this becomes an immigration population sweetener. But also there's a sense that women have more of a role in establishing the societies in the West. Yeah. And so they are more open to having women voting. So it starts with Wyoming, which comes into the Union as a territory with the vote. And then it spreads to Colorado by referendum, Utah, and you get the Western states coming on board, Washington State, California, Oregon. So there's this kind of fortress of suffrage out in the West, but it is, and then the Midwest in the after World War I, a few of those states come around, Michigan, Illinois, but in the Northeast and in the Southeast and the Deep South, it's all on the suffrage map, it's painted black. Those states are painted black because they don't think they'll ever get the states to decide whether suffrage women will vote. And that's why they need a constitutional amendment, which will supersede these state laws. Right. So that's why they're going both on a sort of double track, what Carrie Cack called the winning plan. You get as many states on board to allow suffrage as you can. That puts pressure on Congress, which it did, and then it builds a base of support in those states for ratification.
Yeah, and there were women who were able to vote in like 20 other nations in 1920. You would have thought we would be one of the first, but no.
Oh, no, we're way behind.
Way
I think there's
behind.
Actually 26.
Yeah.
Including Germany, who we just defeated in World War I, and Russia, as soon as the Russian revolution takes hold. So we are way, way behind. And New Zealand, I believe, just celebrated its 125th anniversary.
Wow.
So Carrie Cat uses that as a cudgel, saying, hey, guys, we are way behind in this race, in this idea of equality. Mm-hmm. And I think America better step up. We've just fought this war to make the world safe for democracy, and yet our women can't vote.
Yeah. So I'm going to go back in time a little bit here and going back to Susan Anthony and Elizabeth Stanton and, you know, sort of their fight early on in this. And it's really interesting. You made a point that I thought was really interesting. Over time, the political cartoons of the times changed as this idea of women's rights became more acceptable. So how they portrayed Susan B. Anthony early on versus a little bit later in the political cartoons, it softens, her image softens.
Yeah, it was really fascinating. I'm glad you noticed that in the early depictions of Susan Anthony, and of course, these are drawn because photography was not used in the press yet in the mid-19th century, but these are drawings of her. And she's always depicted as ugly, as are the other suffragists, mm-hmm. by the way. The whole movement, anyone associated with the movement, is depicted as ugly, mannish, unsexed, often wearing men's clothes because they fear that they are usurping the rights and privileges of men. And she is portrayed as this scowling, angry, feminist. Does this sound familiar? Fighter, street fighter. And she's always depicted with this menacing, huge umbrella. I'll let the Freudians have their say on this, but depicted with this weapon of an umbrella, which she really didn't ever carry. But it's a very interesting, and her clothes are ripped and uneven and soiled. And so she's depicted as an outcast and as someone you would not want to engage in conversation in the street. Sometimes they depict her as really crazed looking. And slowly, as she tours the country and as the suffragists make headway in popular opinion, you see editorial depictions of her soften, mm-hmm. and they do not portray her. Her umbrella disappears, and she's not depicted as this angry feminist fighter, yeah. But as a prophet and more as a standard bearer for equality. Of course, she begins her career as an abolitionist. And so Black women are actually revere her. And it's a very interesting view of how our media reacts to a political and social movement, which is frightening at first.
Yeah.
And even at the end, we see many, many editorial cartoons on the anti-suffrage side depicting suffrage women as ugly, and why would a pretty woman want the vote? She should have a man who will vote for her. And they're called radical, they're called subversive, they're called unsexed. And you see that, you still, in 1920, you still see remnants of that, yeah. in depictions of the suffragists.
Yeah, and you mentioned the 1848 convention in Seneca Falls, New York, and one of the big supporters was Frederick Douglass, who was a big fan of Elizabeth Stanton.
Yes. Again, a fascinating part of the story, which I had not known, which is Frederick Douglass. He's only 30 years old at this time. He's only 10 years out of slavery. Attended the Seneca Falls Convention in 1848. He drove his buggy from his home in Rochester at the invitation of Susan Anthony's not in the movement yet, of Elizabeth Cady Stanton. And Stanton and her husband were suffrage organizers. And so Frederick Douglass knew them and knew Lucretia Mott and the other organizers of Seneca Falls through their abolition work. They've been abolition workers for years. And so there's this natural bond between Douglass and the women who see in the treatment of the slaves a sort of echo of women as chattel, women as just, and legally they were the possession of their husbands if you were married. Mm. And so the idea of women's rights actually springs out of the concept of natural rights, of divine rights that are part of the abolition movement, that no one should be a slave, that right. all men are equal. And so it's very interesting to see it's these abolition workers who become suffragists, including the men.
Right.
William Lloyd Garrison and some of the male leaders of the abolition movement are also early supporters of the women's suffrage movement. And Frederick Douglass is truly a hero of my book. He mm-hmm. calls himself a woman's rights man for all of his life. And he truly, truly is. He works for women's suffrage all his life. And he actually dies just hours after appearing at a women's rights convention in 1895. Mm. So we see him as truly a dedicated and faithful supporter of universal suffrage right. for all people.
And then we have John Jacob Vertrees. Tell us a little more about him.
John Jacob Vertrees is one of the leaders of the anti-suffrage movement in Tennessee. He's a very distinguished lawyer. He's a powerhouse in the Democratic Party in Tennessee and even nationally. And he is just dead set against the idea of women voting. And it's mostly for him a racist argument. He does not believe Black women should be able to vote at all. And if Black women are granted the vote through the 19th Amendment, which they are, the 19th Amendment says all women, Black men in the South might get the idea that they should be voting too. Of course, legally, Black men have had the vote since the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendment, but they've been subverted by the Jim Crow laws, and they've been prevented from voting by all kinds of intimidation exercises of power. And so we have someone like Vertrees who sees the 19th Amendment as not only a threat to the American family and to the idea of women being on a pedestal and Southern male chivalry and all these things that he supposedly stands for, but mostly he sees it as a threat to the balance of racial white supremacy in the South. And he also correctly says, you know, if Black Americans can vote, they will probably vote Republican, which they did for the most part, and because it was the party of Lincoln. Mm. And so he's saying the Democratic Party has no interest in promoting all these new voters who are going to vote Republican. So it becomes a party issue too for him. Absolutely. He masterminds a lot of the opposition to suffrage coming in Tennessee, and he suffers a few defeats, a lot of successes, and we see him working behind the scenes and directing Josephine Pearson and her colleagues in how to fight this last stand in Nashville in 1920.
We're talking with Elaine Wise. Her book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We're talking with Elaine Wise. Her book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote. Now, we mentioned Woodrow Wilson was president, and he's looking to seek another term, but that's not going to happen. 1920, he was an invalid. It was his wife, Edith, who decided what mail he should see or shouldn't see, and she's an ardent anti-suffragist. She is totally against this movement. So she has a lot of influence there. And I'm going to go back to 1913 before his inauguration. There was a march of more than 5,000 people from across the country. And you write, Washington had never seen anything like it. And some spectators definitely didn't like it. The marchers were attacked by mobs of irate men and boys, outraged by the sight of women demanding their rights in so public a fashion. Women were grabbed off floats, thrown to the ground, their banners pulled from their hands and smashed, their clothes ripped. The police stood by and didn't intervene, leaving the marchers unprotected. Federal troops from a nearby base had to be called in to restore order. The march and the melee made headlines around the country on the day Woodrow Wilson put his hand on the Bible. And this was intentional. They were looking for that limelight.
Yes, they were. This was Alice Paul's debut in the suffrage movement on a grand scale. She'd been working in the movement. She'd returned from her apprenticeship working with the radical elements of the suffrage movement in Great Britain, the Pankhursts, mothers and daughters. And she brought this idea of staging a great parade in the center of Washington on the day before Woodrow Wilson would take office. And Woodrow Wilson tried to avoid the suffrage issue in any way possible. He ducked and weaved and spoke out of both sides of his mouth. He didn't really support it personally. He comes around to it, I think, for political reasons. And he actually becomes, at the end, an effective and ardent supporter. But at this point, he really does not believe women should vote. And if, in some years hence, he comes around to the idea that women should vote, but only if given that privilege by the state. He does not believe in a federal amendment, knowing full well that his home state of Virginia would never allow their women to vote. So Alice Paul stages this incredible parade and march and tableaus on the steps of the Treasury Department. There are contingents of nurses, of doctors, women doctors. There are contingents from every state and profession. And she does this masterful job. And the story goes that Woodrow Wilson arrives at Penn Station, Union Station in Washington on the day before his inauguration and says, where is everybody? Nobody's here to greet me. And they say, oh, they're all watching the suffrage parade, which does not please him. And Rebecca Roberts has written a beautiful book about the parade. And I think it's worthwhile that any listeners are interested in the details of it. But it's that kickoff of the Women's Party, more confrontational, more spectacular approach to suffrage. Yeah. There had been suffrage parades before. This is not the first. New York had had several very large ones, but this is the most sensational. And of course, it ends in violence, and the police stand by and allow the violence against the women. And that also becomes an issue of how is the government approaching these protesters.
Right. And we have these, as we mentioned, the two different groups that are have the same goal, but acting very differently. And at one point, as we're getting into, you know, they're working their sources, if you will, in Nashville as we're trying to get this ratification. And Carrie Catt comes out and says, yep, we've got the votes. It's going to, you know, so these are the headlines. And now Alice Paul's group and Sue White, they're saying, wait a minute, we don't have the vote. So they're a little upset with Carrie and her, you know, plan. And then, but then they also have that plan, as you mentioned, burning the effigy of President Wilson. And, you know, then Carrie Catt's going, what are they doing? They're both kind of pointing fingers at each other sometimes saying, you're going to ruin this.
Yeah, they really don't trust one another. And again, it's instructive to see two women's, what we would call progressive women's groups who have very different ideas of how to achieve the same goal. And I think there's lessons to be learned from it. They do achieve it, but it is a bit of a very bitter rivalry between them. Yeah. And they both use many of the same tactics, but at a different intensity. And Carrie Catt thinks that the picketing of the White House that the National Women's Party undertakes and some of the more confrontational approaches that they use are undermining the popular support for suffrage. I mean, you know, we saw that in the anti-war movement, we saw that in the gay rights movement. We've seen this happen over and over again. How far is too far? How disruptive can you be before you see a backlash? And that's what we see happen between the two women's suffrage organizations. So it's really fascinating. And again, it's very instructive.
Yeah. I say it was interesting, too, because Sue White and Carrie Catt both think of themselves as the one carrying on the work of Susan B. Anthony. Right. They both think that they're the one.
Yes. Yes. They both claim her as their mentor and guide and almost patron saint. Carrie Catt has that personal tie to her. She was her assistant, her niece, as she called it, one of Aunt Susan's girls. Mm-hmm. This was a coterie of smart young women who Susan Anthony trained up to take over the leadership of the movement. It was a very, very conscious and methodical leadership training program that she undertook. And Carrie Catt was part of that. But the Women's Party sees Susan Anthony as their model and their guiding light because she did exercise civil disobedience. And she voted in the 1872 presidential election, which was against the law in New York, in Rochester, where she lived. She brought a few of her sisters and friends and actually voted. And she was arrested and tried and convicted for illegal voting in a federal election. And she went around New York State giving lectures protesting this and saying, is it a crime for a U.S. citizen to vote? And aren't we asking that question right now?
Right.
So we both sides do claim Susan Anthony. I think she would say she probably inspired both of them. And but you do see again a very different approach to how to achieve the same goal. And of course, we see women's organizations today with the same goal, but very different strategies.
Right. So back to this burning of the effigy of President Wilson, Mrs. Havemeyer, she was sort of a reluctant participant in this, and her family was none too pleased when she got arrested.
Well, so Louisiana Havemeyer is such a wonderful part of this story. She is a extremely wealthy New York socialite woman. She is the widow of Harry Havemeyer, who is called the sugar king. He owned the American Sugar Refinery Company. She was a great collector of modern art. Her impressionist painting collection went to the Metropolitan Museum in New York and is still the centerpiece of their impressionist holdings. So she joins the suffrage movement and expresses a taste for its more radical wing, which is the Woman's Party. She joins it, and she's asked by Alice Paul to give many of speeches. She's one of the most popular speeches. She's a great orator. She's funny. She's a little over the top. She's very eloquent, and she, you know, says it like it is. And you don't expect this grandmother, this wealthy socialite, to be kind of talking trash on the campaign trail. But she agrees to participate in this very controversial protest demonstration, which would burn President Wilson in effigy as he is negotiating the Versailles Treaty in Paris. So this is at the end of the war, and yet they feel that Women's Party is trying to push him to be more aggressive, more twist a few more arms in Congress, because the 19th Amendment at this point was still stuck in Congress. It had been 40 something years. And they're sick of it, and they're going to take that next radical step. And so Louisiana Havemeyer joins this demonstration, as does Sue White, our Tennessee woman who's leading the campaign in Nashville a few months before. She's up in Washington at the gates of the White House, and she is burning it's not really one of those stuffed scarecrow-looking effigies. It's a paper drawing of Woodrow Wilson, but it's still considered scandalous. And other suffragists denounce Havemeyer and Sue White for doing this, saying that it actually sets back the progress of the movement.
But it's interesting, though, just watching the police reaction. They're like, please don't do this. I think, what did they charge her with? Lighting a match or something like that. But they're like, please don't do this. They did not want to arrest her. Please don't do this. But she had to. But you know what? On the sad side, what they endured when they were arrested, and you know, they had the choice of paying a $5 fine or spending 5 days in jail, which they chose the jail. These was horrible conditions.
Yes, and they got off really easy, the group of 20 or so protesters in this particular demonstration in February 1919. Before that, the Women's Party protesters, the picketers, the silent sentinels at the gates of the White House, they were there day and night through all weather. They just stood there with their banners accusing Woodrow Wilson, saying, "Mr. President, how long must women wait for liberty? And democracy begins at home," during the war. And they even have posters that say Kaiser Wilson. That was pretty outrageous. And they are arrested, and Alice Paul is arrested many, many times. And they are given really stiff sentences of months in prison. And they're held at the fetid Occoquan workhouse in Virginia. And Alice Paul's put in solitary confinement. They go on hunger strike because they consider themselves political prisoners. They are force-fed with hoses, tubes, rammed down their noses. They are assaulted. They're manacled to the wall. They're not allowed to communicate. They communicate by singing. And it's really a horrible, horrible situation, and it's one of the great tragedies and one of the most, I guess, despicable parts of the government reaction to the protesters. And I think it's something we have to remember. These women really did suffer.
They did,
cause, not just take to the streets and march.
And so you understand the pride that some of these women were there, the prison pin, that they would wear their prison pins with great pride.
They were. Alice Paul would give each woman who was imprisoned a little silver pin that depicted a jailhouse door. It was actually modeled. The custom had begun in England, and each woman who had endured imprisonment got this jailhouse door pin, and it became a prized possession. It was their Medal of Honor. Hmm.
Well, the book is full of all kinds of interesting surprises that like you say, we have just a couple of sentences here or there when we're learning in our history classes. So a lot of great research that you did on this book, Elaine. Elaine Weiss, the book is The Woman's Hour, The Great Fight to Win the Vote, which just won the Silver Gavel Award from the American Bar Association. Elaine will be at the Nantucket Book Festival. The book festival runs June 13th through the 16th. On the 14th, Elaine and I will be at the Methodist Church at 1 p.m. We'll have more information about the book and the book festival at our website, capeandislands.org. Elaine Weiss, thanks so much, and look forward to talking to you on Nantucket.
I greatly look forward to that too. Thanks so much.
I'm Indy Todd. Thanks for listening.